Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. What is up, Bitcoiners? Hope you all are well out there all over the world. I'm really glad that you're here with me at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. I've got a special episode for you all today. The first repeat interview guest on the pod, my friend Gigi and I got cosmic discussing his, well, for lack of a better term, religious experience at the Bitcoin Honey Badger Conference in Riga. But first, a quick shill for a very important open source Bitcoin project, BTC Pay Server. The Citizen Bitcoin Podcast is all about achieving an understanding of what's happening here and the journey toward becoming a sovereign citizen of Bitcoin. This is why we Bitcoin, to bear our own wealth for ourselves and not to have to trust a nation state or bank to hold it for us or let us spend that wealth. BTC Pay Server was born in that spirit when Nicolas Dorier tweeted to BitPay on August 17th, 2017, that he would make them obsolete after betraying Bitcoiners' trust. BTC Pay is now one of the most important open source Bitcoin projects. It has integrations with many of the top e-commerce platforms and also includes a built-in point-of-sale app for brick-and-mortar retailers. It is a secure, private, censorship-resistant, an absolutely free Bitcoin payment solution. You can support the project at btcpayserver.org/donate. Thanks for supporting open source Bitcoin projects. All right, let's dive into this one. Gigi is a super bullish Bitcoin maximalist, and more importantly, an all-around great guy. After chatting with Gigi about his experience in Riga, I had to invite him back on the show to share his latest brainstorms and experiences about Bitcoin with all of you. Gigi was last on the show 20 episodes ago, episode 34, and in that one we explored the 21 lessons he's learned from his trip down the rabbit hole. As with that episode, I usually prepare thoroughly for the interviews on the show, but for this one I didn't make any notes or prepare any questions. This is just two Bitcoiners shooting the shit and catching up on our latest Bitcoin musings. You'll hear Hasma Cook mentioned throughout this episode. He and Gigi, quote, made sweet music in Riga, as Has put it on John Vallis's Bitcoin Rapid Fire podcast last week. So Has will join me next week on this podcast as a follow-up to this episode with Gigi, so we can experience the full symphony that these two produce in Riga. So make sure you're subscribed for that one. Okay, take a deep breath and settle in for this one. Here we go.
Then let's just see where it goes.
I'm really excited to welcome what I have to call my friend at this point, a Bitcoin friend, Gigi, back to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. How's it going, Gigi?
Yeah, I'm doing excellent. And you know why this intro is perfect? Because I met so many Bitcoiners in Riga, and I referred to them as my new best friends. And my fiance, like, I'm getting married very soon. she actually told me I have to stop calling those people from the internet my new best friends, because that's just a weird thing to do. So it is, yeah, man. Friends it is. It's just friends, and we're friends. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've chatted on DMs and we did a podcast together, and you know, just spent a good half an hour just chatting before this episode. And I had the same thing with several other Bitcoiners out there who I've just gotten to know really well through the internet, just communicating with each other and identifying with each other and just being excited about understanding what's going on here before everyone else, you know, most people in the world understand what's going on. It's really exciting. So exciting that you went to Riga, which was your first Bitcoin conference, right?
Yeah, almost. It was actually my second one, pretty much. I was in New York before that, but Riga was my first Bitcoin experience, let's call it that.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I'm very hesitant to call it a religious experience, but It was just a really weird experience. And I just talked to CK today, like CK Snarks, from Bitcoin Magazine. And he referred to it as my sexual experience with Hess McCook. So huge shout out to Hess. in his words, we played some beautiful music together. And I would agree, it's kind of weird how it is, because we never met before. And I haven't read his stuff before, but our overlap in the Bitcoin world is like 99.99%. Like, he could write my stuff and I could write his. And we're from like opposite sides of the planet, never met each other, and we just aligned perfectly. It's kind of weird. It's, you know, when you said before that you meet Bitcoiners and you become really good friends almost instantly, it's kind of... In my head, it's the same process as Nakamoto Consensus, because you study something very hard and you arrive at a conclusion, but you do that independently. And the same thing happens when you study Bitcoin really hard. You kind of arrive at maximalism and monetary maximalism. And you study all the history of money and you study Austrian economics and you arrive at some conclusions about how the world works. And naturally, if you meet someone else who did the same thing, like studied Bitcoin for 5 years and arrived at the same conclusions, you kind of have something to talk about. And it's a very weird experience. And that's what happened to me in Riga, I would say.
Yeah, but it was like on another level for you in Riga than it is for like most people, right? Because like you, it was, like you said, you hesitate to call it a religious experience. But there was certainly something going on there, because you like had these sleepless nights. You told me that the first night at Riga, your brain was just like in overdrive and you literally couldn't sleep.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it didn't stop. To be fair, the first night is the one I slept probably most, because I got really smashed. I got really drunk with some people and that was a lot of fun and it helped with the sleep, but I didn't sleep too much because obviously I wanted to get up and go to the conference. Yeah. But after that, there was like no sleep for me. I was just too excited because, it was basically seeing the conviction levels of all the people. I'm very convinced that Bitcoin has the right idea. Like I think the details aren't that important. Bitcoin is the one thing that is able to separate money from state. And I also think that we have one shot at this. And I think it's Bitcoin or bust. Like if Bitcoin won't work, if someone is able to fuck with Bitcoin, if someone is able to stop it, if someone is able to influence it in a negative way, then we've already lost. And I think we will not have a second chance to reboot. I mean, maybe we have. I don't want to speak in absolutes. So if Bitcoin for any reason dies, I think it's always possible to reboot from the ledger, because the ledger is basically indestructible information, just like the Bible is. You know, it's just there. I'm pretty sure there are copies of the current Bitcoin blockchain on all kinds of media. Like I mean, I have it on a RAID 5 device, for example, and I have like 5 nodes or something. And there are many people like me. Like there are some people, I'm pretty sure there are some people that store it on very special drives and put it in Faraday cages and stuff like that. You know what I mean? It's just data, and this data is all over the world. And even if we have something approximating a nuclear holocaust, the data would probably survive in some way, shape or form. So, when I say we have one shot, I think if you want to separate money from state, you have to do it in a natural way, just like gold is a natural money. It just occurs on the earth, and it's like a gift from gods. That's what the Egyptians called it, you know.
Yeah, and doesn't Bitcoin feel like that too? It's like a gift. I mean. Yeah, and like, you know, people talk about how Satoshi's an alien or something. This is like this alien technology.
Time-traveling AI.
So there's these aliens out there watching us, this planet, and they're like, let's have a little mercy on these guys and give them this technology that will help them out of this, you know, shithole of a situation that they're in right now.
Yeah, and people talk seriously about this idea. Like, it's the first time that we have fair and scarce money. Like it's literally the first time that we have something that is absolutely scarce. Like Bitcoin is scarcer than time, and it's weird. Like the second and third order effects Bitcoin will have, it will really be mind-blowing, I think. And since Bitcoin is energy, you want to dedicate as much energy as you can to Bitcoin, because just the incentives are set up in that way and people are currently doing that. That's why we see mining operations blow up. And yeah, Hess did a really good job in one of his article series of articulating just how perfect of a competition the whole mining game is and how the future might look like. And people speculate that all of these improvements in energy management and just energy generation, or like putting energy to good use, will usher in something approximating a second renaissance, and we will go to the stars and beyond. Maybe not the stars, but you know, Mars is a really good second planet, at least, and Elon is working on that.
Yeah, Musk coin makes me think of the Dhruv Bansal piece that came out easily, Bitcoin astronomy. The idea, like just exploring how blockchains would work with the limits of the speed of light and the space of the universe between us.
The Bitcoin light radius is really short because of the 10-minute block time. It's kind of hard to mine in outer space and propagate it back. So you kind of have, I think also Alex Svetsky talked about it in one of his recent podcast appearances. He said that it's the perfect incentive to load up the starships and go to like go beyond the Bitcoin radius and start a second proof of work chain.
And, you know, it'll happen, as long as Bitcoin survives, which it will.
I mean, it's very hard to make predictions, especially about the future. But I'm very confident that Bitcoin will outlive me. And that's basically one of my premises. I think Bitcoin will be really hard to kill. And I think it will outlive me, as I said. And also remember that we are still very, very early. Like, I want to stress to everyone who is listening to this, you are still so early, like you have no idea. Bitcoin and also Bitcoiners, this is a very long game we are playing. And I believe I'm hyper bullish. So I think something approximating hyper Bitcoinization will happen in the next 9 years. So I'm even more bullish than Tina sometimes.
That's hard to do.
Yeah, it's really hard to do. And I have to check myself because sometimes I wake up and I think that I'm really literally insane. But, there are at least two or three other Bitcoiners out there that think like me. So I think I'm good. But just remember that we're still in the reward era. And that's so weird because we're currently only in the third reward era. We had two halvings. And the reward era will go on for quite a long time, like until 2140. So that's like 120 years left, you know? Yeah. So we're so early, like we're 10 years in. So the bootstrapping phase of Bitcoin is like 13% done. It's nothing yet, right? You know? And the question
in
is,
in terms of time,
like currently every,
like in terms of time, just not necessarily, not in terms of like, the Bitcoin minted at this point, but yeah, like exactly. That way we're like, what? Like
we have 85% Bitcoin minted. Yeah. And the thing is that the reward era will go on for a very long time, but it won't really matter because the question is, when does the fee market take over? And as you said, we already mined a lot of Bitcoin, like 85% is approximately what we have currently. And I ran the numbers, and these are back of the envelope calculations. So I might be off by a couple percentage points, but it doesn't really matter because I might be off because I did it like 1.5 years ago or something. And I think blocks came in faster than 10 minutes most of the time. So it might be quicker still. But just again, remember the reward era goes to approximately the year 2140. And currently we have 85% of the supply. And I would argue that fees take over when 95 to 99% of the Bitcoin supply is mined. And you can ask yourself the question, when will it be? And this is like in approximately 2025, 26, we will have 95% of the Bitcoin supply mined. And in 2035, we have 99% of the Bitcoin supply mined. And 9 years from now is 2028, and we will have 96% approximately mined. And in 10 years from now, so like if you say 9 years or 10 years, it doesn't really matter, because I say 9 years because in the next 9 years, we will have three halvings. But if it's 9 or 10 years, I don't really care. And it, 10 years from now, 2029, we will have 97.27% of all the Bitcoins mined. And I think we will have a very healthy fee market at that point. And yeah, it's just insane to think about, but I can't see where the math is wrong, and I can't see how Bitcoin should die, even if it has a catastrophic failure. As I said before, I think it could recover. And I agree with Trace Mayer, for example, who says that, yeah, we're 7 billion people and Bitcoin does onboarding one by one, so it will take a very long time. I kind of agree with that, but it's also... The thing is, not everyone has to be a Bitcoiner to use Bitcoin. It's just like not everyone has to know how TCP/IP works to use Snapchat, you know? And there can be a moment in time where just Bitcoin takes over and everything is just priced in sats, and just people get used to this so quickly. Like I lived through the euro, like when the euro got introduced, and I remember the period where the transition was, you know, like all the countries just switched to euro, and it was very different denominations and different names for the currencies before that. Like in all Europe, like you drive with the car 1 hour and you have a different currency. That was Europe before the euro. And people got used to it so insanely quickly, like half a year, and nobody talked about the old currencies except for, you know, old people. But it was just nagging that everything was better, like in the early days. Like when I was young, everything was better. That's basically humanity for you.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I think in terms of like adoption, the idea of exponential technology, and this is why Tina, you know, Bitcoin Tina talks about this all the time, and I think it's probably why you are also super bullish, is that, you know, we have a super hard time thinking in exponentials and what that means. And as this, you know, this technology that's built on top of an already exponential technology with tons of network effects in the internet, and we have, you know, the compounding effects of the network effects of money, right?
Yeah.
And not just any money, the best money humans have ever created, maybe the best money humans could possibly create, right?
Yes.
Just by, you know, the very first principles of Bitcoin, the nature of it itself is just there can't be a better money. You know, it's just this is the definition of what good money is. So that's that idea that spreads, and the network effects are just so powerful. I mean, and they compound on top of each other. So right now we're super early, you know, but you can feel it picking up, right? Even during this past like bear market in terms of price, so much has been built, and there's, you know, so much education going on, so much like just consolidation of all these ideas. And we're like every day on Twitter, we're, you know, distilling all of this collective knowledge that Bitcoiners are bringing from all around the world and into this collection of, you know, 70, 80, like 100 different, like 3 to 5 word memes that basically describe exactly what Bitcoin is. And so we are prepared, like at this point, we're prepared to shepherd this, you know, and the price is the thing that gets people's attention. And so once we have the attention, now we know how to, you know, like evangelize it to everyone else, because we've been working really hard on messaging, basically, you know.
I just had to laugh because you used religious language, and
exactly.
I think there is a reason why religious language works so well, and I'm not exactly saying that Bitcoin is a religion, but Bitcoin is an idea, and as you said, we are honing those ideas, and it's, you know, it's a meme world we are living in. That's for sure. I mean, fucking Donald Trump is president, and we had Brexit because they were just shitposting all over the internet, and just, you know, misinformation spreads on the internet like wildfire. And once you can weaponize that, you can do weird shit online.
You can have a nice EO craze.
You talked about the seven network effects that Trace Mayer identifies, and it's absolutely right. Like those network effects, all of them are exponential. Like network effects are exponential. That's just what they are. And nobody understands exponentials. And we have seven of them in Bitcoin, and we have greed. And greed is a very powerful emotion. Yes. And it's like the only emotion probably that's more powerful than greed is fear. And we have a lot of fear in Bitcoin because we had FOMO in 2017, and this induced like a hype cycle that was beyond belief. Everyone was like, okay, that's it. Hyper-Bitcoinization is happening right now. But just wait until we have state level FOMO. Like if the first governments start to hit Bitcoin hard, and then the dominoes fall, or even if it's like banks, or if it's big institutions, like the really big players, Bitcoin is still so small. Like, you know, just take a couple of yachts, really big boats,
yeah,
and that's Bitcoin. You know, like the market cap of Bitcoin is still so small compared to all the wealth in the world. And I think of it this way, that it's an unstoppable force, it's an unstoppable idea, and it's like Bitcoin's gravity just sucks up all the value there is, just like the internet sucks up all the information there is. If your business model relies on information, the internet will kill you, or you have to pivot to use the internet. That's why Netflix is a thing, or Spotify is a thing, or fucking Gmail is a thing. Just pick your poison. Everything that can be converted into information will be sucked up by the internet, and everything that can be converted into value will be sucked up by Bitcoin. That's how I see it. And as long as Bitcoin keeps doing what it's doing, and that's just producing valid blocks roughly every 10 minutes, then this thing is unstoppable. And the more people realize it, the more we will have, we already have Bitcoiners all over the world, and just the number of Bitcoiners and people that are convinced by this idea will grow, because also, as you said, the ideas, they are getting honed on Twitter and on podcasts like this. And it's just the whole construct that is built around the Bitcoin idea, as far as I can tell, and I studied this thing as hard as I could for the last couple of years, it's really solid. Like, all the ideas are really solid. Yeah. And I'm not the only one who arrived at this conclusion. And this is why it's also important to experience other minds in the real world. I would say that's also why I had such an intense experience in Riga, because I met so many people that are way ahead of me. Yeah. Like I thought I knew a thing or two about Bitcoin, and also I thought that my level of conviction is quite high, but then I met some other people, and I'm just, you know, as always, I got humbled again, and I'm both a noob and a nobody.
So let's talk about this idea that you sent me. You were telling me how you furiously filled up like hundreds of pages in your, with notes while you were in Riga and the following Riga, and just, you know, and I want to get into some of the more out there stuff, because you haven't even shared that with me yet. You just sort of alluded to it in a DM that we were having, and you're like, I have some pretty out there ideas too, if you want to get in them. And I want to. But this idea is the idea that the rabbit hole is circular. The Bitcoin rabbit hole is circular.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a new idea.
Sure.
And I went legit crazy mode in and after Riga. And as you said, I took notes like crazy. Like, I had one idea after the other, and I just tried to put it down because I was afraid I would forget everything. And that was one of them, because, by the way, I tweeted so much, it was unhealthy. And I also wrote some people some really weird DMs. So hodl on out, if you're listening. If I scared you, I'm sorry. Please come back to Twitter. I sent a really weird DM to hodl on out, and he disappeared right after that.
Oh, shit.
So I'm sorry about that. I was just, not sleeping for a couple of days, and my brain wasn't working well. But anyway, I think the rabbit hole is circular in a way that I realized that a lot of people, they get stuck in smaller circles and they don't see the big idea that is Bitcoin. Like Satoshi had the one big idea and he managed to put it into code. And this code, like all he tried to do is make this thing unstoppable. That was his idea. So it the idea is basically unstoppable code. So sorry all to all ETH heads that are crying right now. Like Bitcoin is the unstoppable code. It's not Ethereum. And the thing that I realized in Riga is that there are a couple of stations in the rabbit hole journey and you can identify a lot of people that are stuck in those stations in a way. Like, first of all, you have the idea station and those are the people that are stuck in the white paper and just think that's the religious text. And
there's some people that are literally stuck at the title of the white paper.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, in a way, it's once the idea materialized and was put in the code, it was all about the code. And that's it. Like the white paper, it doesn't even really matter because once the code exists, it's the personified idea, right, in a way. And then you go from the idea to the tech, and then you go from the tech once Bitcoin picked up steam and you had some transactions and people were calculating, okay, it used this much electricity, so I send you 10,000 Bitcoin and you send me, I don't know, 20 cents or something. And then we had the pizza transaction and we all know the story of the pizza transaction. But then it became a financial instrument and some people are stuck in the financial instrument way of thinking. So it's just an asset or it's just a financial revolution, like just quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But it's a financial and also a monetary phenomena. And that's one of the next steps. And that's where the gold bucks are and all the, also the holders of last resort and so on. I mean, all of that, I don't take me too seriously with everything I say because it's kind of a very complex idea construct I have in my head and I don't have it formulated perfectly yet.
It's a rough draft. We're working through it.
Yeah, it's a really, really rough draft.
Yeah,
but right. In a way, it's a financial tool and that's what Beautyon says, for example. It doesn't matter what value Bitcoin has, because you can always take dollars, convert them into Bitcoin, send them somewhere else, and convert them back into dollars or also into yens or whatever. So it is a messaging system for value. That's true. That is true. But it is also more. Like, if you hodl it long enough, it has value. It is the soundest money. It has the highest stock to flow ratio. It will have this highest, like, it will be infinitely hard in the future. So it is super gold. It is like gold 2.0 and so on. So it is money. That is true as well, but it is also more, you know?
Right.
It's because I think it's also a social revolution. And this is where the conviction comes in as well. Like, there is a reason why the Bitcoin maximalist label works, even though it was a derogatory term dreamt up by Vitalik. And people just applied it because, okay, I guess I'm a Bitcoin maximalist now. And I'm in the same boat because I'm not a toxic person at all. Like, if you know me in real life, I really try not to be toxic, you know? I might be toxic on Twitter, but Twitter isn't real life. And the thing is that there is a reason why Bitcoin changes your worldview, for example. So because it's also a social phenomena and you start to think about things very differently. Once you study Austrian economics and once you realize how broken the current financial world really is, it kind of changes you.
Mm-hmm.
And
for sure,
this is where you have another circle in a way where it's just a social movement and people treat it as a social movement and become very tribal. You know, you have the taco carnivore plebs and you have the Bitcoin plebs and you have the toxic maximalists and you have Bitcoin realists. And I don't know, like there are tons of labels that people try to put on other people and people self-identify with. And it's just, it's my team versus your team and so on and so forth. And this is also, where the cult aspect comes in already. But I think there are other multiple stations as well, because as I wrote about, I think Bitcoin is a living organism. And also I think Bitcoin has a certain gravity and we have a whole group of people that see Bitcoin as its own entity, you know, like there is one level of analysis. It's just nodes, you know, and the correct level of analysis is at the node level. There is another point of view where people say it's just code and the correct level of analysis is at the code level. And there are the economists that say Bitcoin is money and the correct level of analysis is it's the hardest money ever and we just focus on the monetary properties. But I take the view that the whole system in itself, it is like an organization or it is like an organism. I like the organism best because it's just very organic.
Yeah.
And it fits the description of life really, really, really well. And so it's kind of its own thing. And that's where it gets really weird because there are some people, you know, like Bitcoin pays people so it stays alive. You can look at it that way. And Ralph Merkel was the first one to do that. But it's you could also say that the idea that Bitcoin embodies, you know, people are possessed by that idea. And then you come back to the cult and maximalism aspect. Like there are some people that are so possessed by that idea. And I include myself. I mean, the last 3 years or so, I couldn't think of anything else than Bitcoin. And it was a very slow process for me. So like my first touch point was maybe 5 years ago or something. And it took me so long to get into Bitcoin. But once I started understanding it, it's literally all I can think about pretty much to the chagrin of my fiance.
I hear that, man.
But it's weird how this unstoppable idea takes also possession of people. And that's where it gets really, really weird because now we have the toxic maximalists and the carnivory and everything. Like it's very cultish already. And that's where I had my sexual experience with Hasna Cook because I believe that Bitcoin religion will be a thing. And I believe that's a far out idea I had like maybe half a year or a year ago or something. It's not a new idea necessarily, but I met Hass and Hass, in my opinion, is the Bitcoin Pope. Like he's amazing. he has a certain aura to himself and he just has the religious aspect of it down to a T. And I think we will see even like he does it in a funny way, like it's not serious at all, but we will see something like that. And I think we already see that happening. I mean, we have rituals like, you know, stacking sats and also like proof of keys, for example, like yearly events. We have the Bitcoin Pizza Day as one of the celebratory days. And you have like daily rituals like checking your Casa note and just stuff like that. It's really weird how well it fits to the description of a religion. And that's where I think that was a very, very long explanation of why I think that the rabbit hole is circular. Because once you are at the religion and idea level again, it goes back to what Satoshi started. You know, it's an unstoppable idea. And the end result of an unstoppable idea is kind of a worldwide religion in a way. And I use this term very, very loosely. So don't take me too seriously when I say religion. I use the kind of dictionary Yuval Harari definition of the world religion. And according to Yuval Harari, something like Star Wars could be seen as a religion as well. So just please don't shoot the messenger.
It's not like, I think it's just that, you know, we grasp at analogies for Bitcoin because we're trying to understand what's going on here. And it's, you know, like you said, beyond just money, which is kind of the first apparent, you know, thing that Bitcoin is, one of the first. And it goes way beyond that, though. And we're trying to grasp at all these analogies. We use, you know, organisms, mycelium and mushrooms and planting a tree all of those things, that it's an intelligent form of AI, some new form of life, that it's gravity, you know, that it's energy, all this. And I think religion is just the closest analogy we have to describe, you know, the potential of this social movement. Because the idea, I mean, religion is really just there's a meme at the center of it, at the heart of it.
Yeah, exactly.
An idea, and that idea is just catches on fire and spreads, and then the religion gets, you know, built around it, right? And I agree. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing it is a good analogy. It works. And it's not like a traditional religion like we might think of. Like you said, it's a very loose definition. But yeah, the analogy is there. And I feel it. I've been feeling it for quite a while too. And I know that like Pierre and Michael, on the Noted podcast, I've joked about it several times about, you know, a Church of Satoshi.
Yeah, exactly.
My friend Guy Swan, I think he owns churchofsatoshi.com, you know, so he's like he's planning ahead.
We're set.
yeah, exactly. I got the Twitter handles at Saved by Satoshi. So
awesome.
I'm holding on to that one.
The thing is, you know, now it's just all fun and games and jokes and so on. But I really believe that it will be very hard to discern what Bitcoiners will be doing in the future. And I'm just talking future stuff, you know, like my time horizon again is like 9 years. In the next 9 years, we will have some crazy people doing crazy shit in the Bitcoin space. I can guarantee you that, because like we had it in the past, we have it today. So we will have it in the future. And I can imagine that people, for example, and you know, I might be part of that because I'm spreading this idea now, but don't take me too seriously. But I can imagine that people do rituals like burning Bitcoin. You know, you have someone like American HODL who has, I don't know, probably a little bit more than 6.15 BTC, to be honest. And you could just like do a big ceremony, you know how very important private keys are generated? Those are big ceremonies. Like also the privacy coins try to do it in that way. You have a ceremony with live feeds that everyone can see what is happening. And so you generate, you initialize a new hardware wallet, whatever. You generate new keys. You do it with dice, whatever. Then you load it up with one Bitcoin and you burn it. You know, that would be a proper religious ceremony, and you do that once a year, and you do that for the public good, because everyone's Bitcoin will be worth more. And I can imagine that people will literally do that. I mean, you know, I don't want to give people ideas, but still, you heard it here first.
Well, actually, I remember a tweet from Parabolic Trav, you know, at kind of the height of the big run. I remember him talking about, I think it was something along the lines of, in the future, in a Bitcoin future, the greatest form of philanthropy will be a billionaire burning all his sets.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Same idea. Exactly.
Same idea. Yeah. Because then you give it to everybody, right? Kind of equally. Exactly, you're not just like picking out one cause or something.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I think that also we see it with just stacking, like with so many HODLers of last resort. And that's something I realized for myself as well. Like I'm not rich by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm rich because I'm in a first world country, you know, like no matter what I do, I will not be like, I won't be dying in the streets and starving. Like I'm from Central Europe and we have a very, very comfortable social security net. So no matter what I do, I'm pretty much as unstoppable as American HODL. I can do Bitcoin full time until the end of my life, even if I don't earn anything, you know. I'm willing to do that. And the thing is that I realized that in Riga as well, that there are a lot of people that have a conviction level of American HODL, you know. Like he said in one of the pods, like, how do you stop me? And that really stuck with me, because I was like, okay, how do you stop American HODL? You just don't. Like, he's a fucking millionaire. He has a huge stash of Bitcoin. He's not shy to brag about it. He buys houses left and right. He's so rich, he can move to another country instantly. Like if something happens in the jurisdiction he's currently living, he can just pack his shit and move easily.
Right.
And just go somewhere where the jurisdiction is just favorable to his lifestyle, pretty much. And his lifestyle is being maximalist. That's his lifestyle.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane. It's an insane world we're living in. So that's for sure.
So what do you think like socially the world will be like in a Bitcoin future? I mean, there, you know, there's all kinds of possibility out there. We talk about this idea of this decentralized network of citadels where people sort of align themselves by the type of political experimentation they're drawn to, or the type of like their tribe, right? Then we have this, you know, basically ability where people can just move around and live in the way that they want to live. They'll find others that are of like mind and naturally gravitate towards them. Do you think that that's like a possibility? What other possibilities might play out in the next, you know, 100 years?
Yeah. That's a $100 trillion question. I have no idea how it will.
It's fun to think about.
It's really fun to think about. It's also not fun to think about, because there could be very dark scenarios in the future as well. And I still think that, like, Bitcoin is full of contradictions. And what I will talk about now is it might sound contradictory, but it kind of is not. Like, for example, on the one hand, having good OPSEC is still a very good idea, and doing everything you can to have plausible deniability, and just don't let yourself be surveilled. That's all what I'm saying. Just do everything you can to have privacy, have proper security measures in place. Don't lose your coins for real. Like, just have proper boarding accidents. And because shit could get really ugly really quickly, I think. Again, I mean, there might be some privileged people that are able to hop to a different country and just ride out the storm. But the way I see it, it's almost impossible to tell how the future will be. And I really like what Hasmek Cook is saying about the future. It's like, on the one hand, we could have heaven, and on the other hand, mm-hmm. we could have hell. Both things are possible, and it depends on how the powers that are currently in place decide to treat Bitcoin. Like, I think the best way to live with Bitcoin is to enter into a symbiosis with it, because if you want to fight Bitcoin, you will inevitably lose. And I also like what Hus says about that, that Bitcoin is nature in a way. It's like, yeah, if you want to channel a river, you can do it, but you can only do it for a couple of years, you know. Like, if the river has its own mind, and it will find the way of least resistance. And the way I see it in Bitcoin, there are a couple of facts. Like, Bitcoin exists, first of all, it's a thing. And as Budion said, Bitcoin is, and that is enough. That's a really deep insight in my book, because Bitcoin obviously works, and it didn't die yet. So the conclusion of that is that it's really hard to kill, because obviously people tried to kill it. I mean, everyone is writing about how Bitcoin is dead now, but it just refuses to die. And what I also think is a fact is that the world is moving really, really fast. Like, you know, almost 10 years ago, smartphones weren't a thing. And it's like 12 years ago or something, but approximately 10 years ago, the current world we are all taking for granted, the world of podcasts and YouTube and Twitter and everything, it didn't exist. And also, I still remember a time where gay marriage just wasn't a thing. And the whole society globally, pretty much globally, shifted completely. Like, gay marriage is absolutely a thing now, and it happened so quickly. Like, again, it was an exponential process, especially in the US, you know. It was just like, there was one state first, and then another one, and so on. And then it happened all at once, and suddenly gay marriage is legal. And I see Bitcoin as a social movement as well. And it's all of that, you know. It's money, it's fintech, it's a technology, it's code, it's an idea, it's a social movement, it's also a cult, and so on. But it's also more than that. Like, Bitcoin is its own thing. And I think the world could adapt to Bitcoin really quickly, because you could also have something like what I call the voice over IP moment for Bitcoin. Like, everyone is using phones all the time. And there was one point in time where the companies behind it were like, okay, it makes way more sense to do everything that has to do with phones over the internet. And we just do this voice over IP thing. And then we just flip a switch, and every single phone will go over the internet, and just nobody notices, you know. Like, nobody gives a fuck how things work. And everyone is paying with cards nowadays, everyone is paying with their mobile phones, and everyone is paying with NFC chips, and nobody gives a fuck what's underneath. Like, it could work on Bitcoin, and I think it absolutely will in the future. I mean, just look at what Square is doing. Square is hiring Bitcoin developers, core developers, left and right, and they're just pouring money into the system. They're not doing mm-hmm. it out of goodwill. Yeah. Like, it's a company. No company is doing that out of goodwill. So, they have a plan, I guess. And their plan includes Bitcoin, I guess. And what Square is doing is just they offer a complete finance solution for everyone.
They're going to be a global, bank based on Bitcoin. Yeah.
Exactly.
And they're positioning themselves
Exactly. Yeah, that's what's happening. And they're also doing it out in the open. I mean, that's no secret that Square Crypto exists mm-hmm. and that they are hiring core developers. And one day you might have the option on your point of sale device or on your phone. Hey, if you switch to the Square system, it's like 10% cheaper because they will not have to pay the fees for the banks. And then, they're set. I mean, that's the first company to do it. And then everyone else has to catch up because otherwise Square will win against every competition because they're the cheapest payment provider. And it's, for me, it's just obvious what's happening. And I think it's happening all over the place. Also, Microsoft is doing identity solutions on Bitcoin. And I mean, what Facebook is doing with Libra is just kind of stupid, but they are not stupid. So they want to also separate money from state. They just want to do it in their own way. And so, yeah, the world is moving fast. And I think the next 10 years will be very interesting.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movie Waking Life? By Richard Linklater.
I haven't seen it.
So this is like a movie that's just about the sort of crazy, probably sleep deprived induced musings of this guy named Richard Linklater. He's a filmmaker, and it came out like 20 years ago or something. But it's really cool. The movie's animated by 30 or 40 different artists. And so it has all these different styles, just a bunch of different scenes throughout the movie. And there's kind of one character that is kind of the thread that combines and ties together the whole movie. And it's kind of about this waking dream. And he just goes from this like amazing conversation to amazing conversation to amazing conversation in between each scene. And one of the scenes, he's talking to this crazy professor. And he's just like, the professor's like, yeah, so we're living, like, imagine, you know, like we had a big chunk of progress that took like, you know, humans like 500,000 years. And then we had the agrarian revolution and we had the same amount of progress in 10,000 years. And then we had the industrial revolution. We had the same amount of progress in like, a few hundred years. And then we have the information age and we have the same amount of progress in like 50 years. And now it's just, it's just going to keep stacking and stacking. And it's just this exponential trend. And eventually we'll have this evolution upon evolution. And it'll be happening so fast that we'll, who knows what it will be like, what the experience will be like, but it'll, it'll just be, we'll be melded with the man and machine will sort of be melded together. And we'll, the only way that we can kind of experience this, just insanely fast evolution of understanding and technology and all that is to merge ourselves with machines and experience reality in a new and different way. And it's a really trippy scene, but it sticks with me all the time. And I think about it and think back to it a lot. And it's happening now. We're living in this sort of like the elbow of the asymptote, of this just like long historical human progression. And we are right now living at this key point where, you can within a human lifetime experience an insane amount of progress. And it's kind of, dizzying and disorienting.
It is. It is. It is. It is very dizzying. And I'll have to watch the movie for sure. Like I studied exponential technologies kind of professionally in my academic life. And I looked into the singularity movement quite a bit. So what you're describing is the proper term for it is the technological singularity, where just nothing makes sense anymore because you have self-improving AI. And it's a very interesting idea. I think the main idea is perfectly right. Like we obviously have an insane amount of technological progress. Like it's literally insane. Like everyone takes it for granted. Everyone has like a supercomputer in their pocket, and you can do video streaming and video conferencing, and you can call anyone on Earth instantly. You can tweet with everyone on Earth instantly, and it's really insane. You have all the knowledge of humanity at your fingertips. You can watch all the movies, listen to all the songs, just with the supercomputer in your pocket, and it's so insane. Like I have a very hard time with that already because I'm just blown away by it every fucking day. I pull out my smartphone and I'm blown away. Like what this thing can do, and people also are so oblivious about it. Like most people, as the saying goes, watch cat videos or do some stupid shit. Most people don't use the smartphones to educate themselves. Like you can have a university level education or even better than that just by self-studying, just by using your smartphone. And this is coming from a guy who read probably like 100 books in the last 2 years on his smartphone. It's weird what you can do. And it's also weird how Bitcoin fits into this picture, because I think Bitcoin could be the monetary base for all future progress, because there is also there is an argument to be made that easy money destroys technological progress in a way because it misallocates capital. And I believe this to be true. And the question you asked previously, like how the future will turn out and how this social movement will turn out and so on, I really don't have a good answer, but I truly believe that we are experiencing Bitcoinization firsthand. And I truly believe that we are living through it right now. I think that's obvious. And I think that something approximating hyper-Bitcoinization could happen in the next 9 years. And even if it's not 9 years, I think I'm not off by let's just say 10 years. And I'm not off by an order of magnitude, I don't think. I don't think it will be 1 year, and I don't think it will be 100 years. I think it will be 10 years. So if it's 9 or 15, I don't care. It will be something that the people that say it's 50 years, I think they're crazy. Like, I think it will go way quicker. The world moves so quickly.
I agree.
And the questions I ask myself, in a way, how far speaking in years are we into it? Like, when is the point when we can look back and say, okay, like 2029, this was hyper-Bitcoinization, you know? It's really hard to say. And also, like, the technical questions are, like, when will the fee market take over? Like, when will block subsidy cease to be the main motivation of miners? And also, how bad will the transition be? Like, obviously the current financial system is just a mess. I mean, we have negative interest rates, we have all kinds of weird things going on, we have currency wars, we have financial constructs that don't make any sense at all. And it's what I ask myself as well, is also, when will the old system kind of wake up? If it does at all, like, will it be replaced completely, or will there be a transition period where the current system, like the current banks, and also let's say also the whole insurance world or something like that will pivot to Bitcoin in a way? Like, Bitcoin is obviously the new sound money base, and I think there could be an easier transition if the existing institutions try to pivot to Bitcoin slowly, like allocate 1% of your capital in Bitcoin, or at least try. And then it might be okay. Like, if the old system crashes and burns, it won't be pretty, because that's never pretty. And I don't want to see that. Like, you will, if the old system really crashes and burns hard, then people will be starving in the streets, just like we have in Venezuela. Like, it's not a nice thing to happen. So I'm hesitant to cheer for that. It would be way better if the world does not fall apart and just Bitcoinization continues to happen kind of slowly as it does now, even though I don't think it's slow. It's just in waves, and it's kind of insanity, and then it crashes again down by 80-90%. If the cycles continue to happen as they happened in the past, I'm perfectly fine with that, because I think then it will be kind of slow and steady, even though I think in the next 10 years we will have something that we could call, we might call hyper-Bitcoinization. Like, most things are priced in sats, and Bitcoin overtook gold and destroyed gold's monetary value, for example, or the euro is gone, the US is, like, the US dollar has its problems, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, it makes sense. And, like, I think where we're heading is, you know, just kind of a general outline is, like, we have Bitcoin, and then we have some kind of, like, Federal Reserve coin, some kind of central bank coin that gets used around the world. So maybe the United States Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, would create it, or maybe it even be created by an institution like the Bank for International Settlements, something like that.
Yeah, maybe.
I think the Fed is probably the most likely, just because the dollar is, you know, the global currency at this point. And then we'll have some kind of corporate coin.
Yeah,
that maybe will battle against Fed. So it'll be like some big government coin, a corporate coin, and then, you know, the open source native currency of the internet. And
that's
battling for the domination of, you know, money. And I think Bitcoin wins in the end, but I think that that's sort of going to be the shape of the final battle, will be sort of between those three attempts at controlling the money.
Yeah, maybe, but I think and that's where we come back to, it's all of the, it's already a war, and currently it's a war to win the minds and hearts of the people.
Right.
And we already have, I think Bitcoin already won the minds and hearts of the most curious people. And this is not my idea. So I'm basically quoting and channeling a bunch of other people. Most likely all of this was said by Hess McCook before I said it. Bitcoin maximalists, they're all over the place. Like, there are so many, you wouldn't believe it. But just we just have closet maximalists, you know, like we have Bitcoiners that just never talk about Bitcoin, and they're anon and they know what they are doing, and they're just leaning back, stacking sats, and that's it. So people like that, I think they will never use a corporate coin or a government coin, because if it comes to that, they will move. And if you have just one country out of all the countries in the world where you can use Bitcoin freely, I think a lot of people would move to that. And I think it will be a very prosperous country. So this would be a good move spoken from a country level perspective. And it's a little bit like, okay, now we have the internet, but maybe it will be a good idea to introduce the government internet or reintroduce AOL and just force people to use it. It just doesn't work like that. I think people will use Bitcoin anyway, just like people use the internet anyway. If you try to take the internet away from the people, like they tried to do in the Arab Spring, for example, they will put graffitis on walls how to circumvent this restriction and input like the proper DNS settings and how to set up a VPN and so on. Like, there were graffitis on the walls all over the place, and people were using the internet anyway, even though they got shot in the head by a tank. You know what I mean? It's like introducing the government coins and stuff like that. I think they will try, and the only way this could kind of work for a little bit, if they do it really properly and also reintroduce sound money, then you have competing sound monies. But I think just the ledger, the 10-year history of the ledger, is a force on its own, because, I mean, we have very wealthy Bitcoiners already, and they can just, they can just flex. They can flex and just talk to the politicians and lobby like nobody's business and stuff like that.
Yeah, and like you said, like that stuff's happening behind the scenes too. I mean, there's Bitcoiners that are anons that are very powerful people, I'm sure, in this world.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, the Libra hearings, they kind of show that we have Bitcoiners in Congress. We just didn't know it yet.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if there is some kind of corporate coin that gets the blessing of the state, because, you know, like we saw with the Libra hearings, you know, basically what came out of that is that the government, the Federal Reserve, was like, hey, we're going to have to probably do something because we can't let Facebook run the money, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to just fight with each other naturally. Right. And the cool thing about Bitcoin's massive advantage is that the state, you know, generally I can't do anything about it. Like, it's strong enough at this point to survive state level attacks. We presume. But at the very least, like,
it's not easy to kill.
It's not easy. Yeah. It's definitely not easy.
Yeah.
And the easiest way for a nation state to accumulate Bitcoin at this point is to mine it, because, you know, then you're not really affecting the spot price and driving it up, you know. I think the next step for a very clever nation state that's looking forward and going to, you know, become the physical central location of Bitcoiners, you know, the first one, you know, the first move is just start mining it quietly, you know, and accumulate.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the most anonymous way to get Bitcoin.
And then come out and say, hey, you know, Bitcoiners are welcome here. We are, you know, it's perfectly legal. We'll operate our economy on Bitcoin. Eventually, we'll move there. We want. That's the vision for our future. Is we want to have our national economy run on Bitcoin.
Yeah. It will be the first citadel country. That's
right.
For sure.
Yeah, exactly.
And I really think that it can happen way more quickly than most people think. Like, I'm hyper bullish, and it's, again, I have to check myself all the time, because it's kind of insane. On my good days, I'm more bullish than Bitcoin Tina, and as you said, that's really hard to do. But I think you know, currently the crazy maximalists, they are just crazy maximalists. Most of them are crazy, and most normal people that talk to them, everyone thinks I'm crazy. Like I'm legit crazy if I talk to normal people about Bitcoin, and I usually don't, because I usually talk about Bitcoin without talking about Bitcoin. But if I talk to one of my quote unquote normie friends about Bitcoin, they just think I just escaped the psych ward.
same.
And I think it could be a rather quick transition where the crazy maximalists, they're not the crazy maximalists anymore, but they're just regular people, because I'm just a regular guy who studied Bitcoin really hard. I'm like, you couldn't tell that I'm a Bitcoiner, really. Like, I'm just a regular guy, and I had a regular job, and I do all the regular things, and it's not obvious to me that it will take a long time, because, for example, to come back to the previous example I took with social movements, the gay movement, it happened really quickly. Like, you have a bunch of closet gay guys, and or also women, of course, and it's a social movement, and the laws changed almost overnight, you know? Like, it took a very long time, and it was a very long fight, but it was an exponential progress, and suddenly gay marriage is normal and legal in most parts of the world.
Gradually, then suddenly.
Exactly. And the funny thing about Bitcoiners is it's not like 10%, it doesn't stop at 10% of the population, because with every adoption cycle, more Bitcoiners are born, you know? Like, it's literally like that. Like, as some people stick around and they really get it and they become Bitcoiners, and eventually they become Bitcoin maximalists because nothing else really makes sense. Money is in competition with all other money, and Bitcoin is the hardest, soundest, best money we have. So it's competing against everything else. So being a monetary maximalist, it's the sensible thing to be. And so I don't know how many hype cycles it takes. Maybe it takes only two or three, and this would be like 10 years, like three halvings in the next 10 years. It's probably like three or maybe even four hype cycles. I'm not sure if they always coincide with the halvings, because if the financial crisis hits the next one, we will have a hype cycle for sure. I think it will be quote unquote good for Bitcoin. I don't think a financial crisis will be good for the world, but I think a lot of people will flock to Bitcoin. And it's not obvious to me that it will take as long as the gay movement, for example. It could only take, like, yeah, as I say, like 9-10 years, and then it's done.
Yeah, I mean, that would just be astonishing to look back and say, you know, Bitcoin is 20 years old, you know?
someone, please tag this and do a, like, remind me tweet in 10 years and just laugh me out of the room in 10 years because everything I said is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it like, you know, Bitcoin's 10 years old right now. You know, it's like a precocious fifth grader and, like, you know, it's growing up. But then by the time you're, you know, the Bitcoin's like 2021, it's, you know, just to compare it to like a human life, it's really kind of ready to sort of blossom into its full potential. Like, all of the geniuses throughout human history have done their best work in their early 20s, you know, 20 to 25 years old.
That's a $100 trillion question. How long does it take until Bitcoin becomes an adult, so to speak?
Yeah.
Or it's really hard for me to say, but again, I don't think it will take until the year 2140, and that's like in the protocol, that's the last real timestamp we have, because after the reward era, it just does its thing, and I'm very confident that it will do its thing, because, as I said before, I'm confident that the fee market will take over and it will be a stable system no matter what.
Yeah, and you know, it's just this, it's a base layer. It's going to get buried underneath, you know, layer and layer of abstraction, and people won't, like, you know, in after hyper Bitcoinization, people aren't going to be like watching the Bitcoin like ledger, except for like a few people who, you know, relatively few people, a small percentage of people on the planet are going to be interested in watching what's happening on the blockchain, because that's their job, is to sort of, you know, monitor final settlement for whatever massive organization they're working for, right? And then nerds, of course, like us, who might, you know, just have been around for a long time and are just following it because that was habit from a long
just
time
because
ago.
It can.
And it's interesting. Yeah. But, you know, we have Lightning Network now, and then we have already, and I talked to Jacques Mazzucco about this last week, we have already layer three protocol proposals out there that are being built on top of Lightning.
Yeah. We also have Liquid, for example. Yeah. I think, I think it will be more complicated than the network layer stash. And I kind of know that stash pretty well, like all the layers, all the OC layers. I studied all of them, and it's insane how complicated the internet is if you really study it up and down. But I think it will be even more insane how complicated the future of a financial system will be, because Lightning is already kind of complicated. It's not easy to wrap your head around it. And it's just the second layer. I mean, I think for me, it's obvious that, Bitcoin is just the source of truth and the anchor for everything, and just the base chain. And I really like the container ship analogy. Like, you have no idea how container ships work, and you have no idea how the containers themselves work. Like, they're really high tech stuff. Like, shipping containers are serious business. And that's also why, like, the whole block size debate, in my eyes, in retrospect, to be fair, is so stupid. Because if you want to introduce a new shipping container to the world, it has to be like 1,000 times better than the current one, because every single harbor and every single ship is built for exactly one size of shipping container. You know what I mean? Like, yep. Changing these protocols is, like, the network effects are so insanely strong. You, like, a 10x improvement wouldn't even cut it. You would have to be like a 100x or 1,000x to convince everyone to change. And that's the world of Bitcoin. You would have, on the base layer, you would have to convince everyone who uses Bitcoin to change the way of doing things.
Yeah.
And it's not a technical challenge. It's a social challenge.
Yeah, there's just so much value built onto it already that you exactly. Literally can't undo it. You know, that, like you said, the shipping container size, like if there was some engineer that was, you know, putting together a proposal to make the shipping container
twice as big.
Yeah, like, yeah, we'll be more efficient with this particular dimensions, right? And everyone's going to be like, okay. Yeah, we have, like, you know, however many millions of shipping containers. Okay, let's just scrap them all and rebuild it, the whole system. Yeah. No, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and also rebuild all the harbors, rebuild all the cranes, rebuild all the lorries, rebuild all the ships, rebuild everything that is dependent on the shipping container size. And it's I think it's a perfect analogy in that way. And everyone who has the chance to watch something like that in real life, like a big harbor or even something like the Panama Canal or something, just go and watch it. Like, shipping containers are serious business.
Yeah, it is a really good analogy. And it's why, you know, there's not going to be, like you said earlier, we have this kind of one shot, this chance. Like, Bitcoin is it. There's so much momentum behind it already. Combined with the fact that, you know, market chosen monies tend toward one, combined with the fact that, you know, network protocols tend toward one, you know, basically we, you know, there's the shelling point has been arrived at for the most part, right? And it's just really early. So there's relatively few people, you know, although, like you also said, more than we think out there who have adopted this. But, you know, like, if you look at the back of the protocol wars, and I've been doing a little bit more research on this lately. So TCP/IP was that stack was just a, you know, open source. It was just really just kind of a few developers, a band of developers that were kind of all over the place, early internet adopters, mostly at universities, that put together this open protocol so that they could, you know, talk to each other on the internet and make better use of the internet. And then, you know, there were other alternatives out there too, like Gopher, which had some adoption. It was came out of the University of Minnesota. And then we had the OSI, the Open Systems Institute, I think, or something that put together a coalition of a bunch of corporations and universities and governments, and, you know, mapped out this beautiful spec for the internet protocol. But at that point it was too late. TCP/IP had enough momentum behind it that, you know, there's just, it was good enough and it had the momentum and even all of the weight of all of those, you know, large institutions had no, you know, ability to affect that.
Yeah, the thing with institutions and also companies is they eventually die and open systems live forever. And you can really see this with the free Libre open source movement. And everyone is calling it open source nowadays, but that's actually kind of incorrect, because the distinction is very important. You have the founder of the free software movement, Richard Stallman. He's very, very religious about this idea. And he also like jokingly puts on a robe and does a ceremony and stuff like that. But it is a very, it is a religious idea. It's a, such an important idea. There is a difference between open source software and free software, because free as in freedom implies that you can do with it what you want. And open source software, there are some restrictive open source licenses where you can't do with the software what you want. And that's just a detail. It doesn't really matter. But in a way, if you have a, if you have something like Windows 95 and you have something like Windows 95 server, you can already tell that it won't be working anymore in like 5 years. And that's why the whole internet is built on Linux servers, because it's just open source software and it's an open system and you can do with it what you want. And that's why the whole internet is run like all the server infrastructure, it's all open source. It's all free software, and free software won in the end. It won the war, and it was a very long, very subtle war, but it won it because it's an open system. All the companies that tried to sell closed source systems in the past, they all went out of business eventually. Like, I mean, companies die, even huge companies like Coca-Cola, it won't be around in the next 5,000 years. It just won't. But there is an argument to be made that open source tools and open source software, or like also open source texts, like religious texts, they will be around for a very long time. Like if you're a computer programmer, you still use the shell tools that are written, and you still use the editors that are written in the 60s and 70s, you know, and you still use them every day, and they are the best editors because they evolved in the like over like 60, 70 years. And it's insane to think about that in that way, but it's profoundly true, because if you use something that is bound to a company and the company goes out of business, then you can't use the product anymore. And so you have to use something that is not bound to a company. And that's also why I think that eventually we will have also systems in the current world that are different from Spotify and YouTube and Kindle and stuff like that. Because if Amazon goes out of business tomorrow, all your books on your Kindle, they're just gone. You know what I mean? And I think people have to realize the difference between something that is free and open and does not control you, and you can just use it in whichever way you want, and something that's not. And we already saw with the Amazon Kindle, for example, that they deleted books from devices. And I'm pretty sure we will see similar like small catastrophes like that, and people will eventually revert to more open systems where the user is in control. And Bitcoin is such a system to the T. Like, you control everything. If you are a good Bitcoin citizen, you control everything. You control your own keys, you control your own node, you watch your own, like you sign your own transactions with your node, you will use your node to watch your addresses, stuff like that. And I think that's also one of the main reasons why it will succeed, because it is a system that allows it. And I have to correct myself. I think Bitcoin already succeeded in a way.
Like, you know, like Beyond says, Bitcoin is, and that is enough. Yeah. And exactly. The moment of success was the second user after Satoshi, you know, joined the network and started mining, which, you know, could have been Hal Finney. I mean, he was right up there. If it wasn't Hal Finney, he was very close. But yeah, when the second person joined the network and started mining, and the first, you know, Satoshi's node connected to a second node, and that's sort of the moment that Bitcoin became successful, right? Like, yeah. It was, you know, it just started working, and from that moment forward, it, you know, it is, and that is enough.
Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I think it just takes time now. Like, we have to be patient. And I can't tell you exactly how long it takes, and my time frame might be off. But again, like, even if it's twice that, if I'm off by 100% and it's not 10 years but 20, it's still really fast. I don't think it will be 100 years. I think it will, like, hyper-Bitcoinization will happen quicker than that. But still, it takes time, and yeah, we all need to try to, as Matt Odell says, stay humble and stack sats and just do what we can to be good Bitcoin citizens, onboard new people, help them, be understanding, and just, you know, I was a shitcoiner once, so there's that. And I think a lot of people just need a lot of time to understand all of it, and that dabbling in shitcoins is not a good idea, and there is no Bitcoin 2.0, for example. And it's a difficult beast to understand, but I think the most important thing is that this beast is almost impossible to stop, and that's why I'm really hyper bullish on Bitcoin.
Dan Held calls Bitcoin the apex predator of money.
Yeah,
it's exactly. A beast, and it can't be stopped.
Yeah, it's a beast.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I got anything else in me. It feels like I talked for 2 hours, but we're only 1 hour, 10 minutes in.
So. It was dense.
I think.
Do you have any like crazy out there ideas that popped into your mind when you were?
Because everything we had up to now is just normal stuff, you know. It's not crazy and not far out.
Even more far than
I'm not sure. I think, you know, the craziest idea probably is that the rabbit hole is circular in a way, but it's not really a new idea and it's not that crazy. But the way I picture it is it actually looks like a circle, and it builds up a mirror, and it like Bitcoin reflects back to you what you believe about the world. And if you are a tech bro, then you might think that Ethereum is a good idea, for example. If you're a finance guy, you just want to trade it and so on and so forth. So Bitcoin is just a huge mirror. And there is a quote from a book I read a couple of years ago. It's Claude Atlas. There is a Hollywood movie about it as well, and I think it's quite good. But one of the characters says there that knowledge is a mirror, and for the first time, I kind of knew who I was and knew who I could become. And I feel like Bitcoin does that to you as well. Like
absolutely.
It reflects back to you what you know, and it also reflects back to you what you don't know. And for me in Riga, it felt like there are some Bitcoiners that really understand that, and they're waiting for you behind this mirror. So that was one of the very far out ideas / dreams I had in one of the nights where I wasn't sleeping.
Yeah, I mean, I tweeted about this the other day, and I was thinking about how much just in 2 years, you know, how long has it been now? Like it's everything kind of just runs together, but a bit over 2 years. I think it was like kind of early summer 2017 when I really kind of started studying in earnest. And
sorry to interject, but I just have to laugh like an insane person, because once you switch to block time, regular time doesn't make sense anymore. And I really feel that all the time. Like, was that yesterday or was it 2 weeks ago? I don't know. Yeah. Everything is just a blur. And it's, you know, there's this concept of regular time, and then there's internet time. Like if a meme is 2 years old, it's like ancient in internet time. But then there is also Bitcoin time, and it feels like it's exponentially faster as well. Like in Bitcoin time, like I don't know when the HODLing out fallout happened and everyone was HODLing out, but it's probably like, I don't know, 4 months ago or something.
Yeah,
I have no idea when it was, but it's not long ago, but it feels like ancient history to me. Like it feels to me like I could just grab a history book and open it up in the middle, and it would say # we are all HODLing out.
Yeah, I hear that, man. I mean, it's really changed my life in a lot of ways.
Lesson one.
And it's, you know, I think I got a little pushback from some people, because I, in my tweet, I was like, you know, it's actually made me a better father, a better husband, better friend. They're like, yeah, it's like somebody tweeted like step one, buy Bitcoin, step two, ? Step three, better father, better husband. You know, it's like, what the fuck are you talking about, you crazy man? And
Bitcoin fixes everything.
Yeah, but it makes sense when you think about it and you understand what's going on. It's really, you know, the Austrian school wrote about this extensively.
Exactly.
It's human action. It's, you know, the follow-on effects of adjusting your time preference is that you become more, you know, cognizant of your spending, become more disciplined. You think about the future. The future becomes more important to you, so you are more thoughtful about it. You're more thoughtful about the present. You're more thoughtful about the value of your time in general. And so that all of those things make you a better person, make you a better friend, a better husband, better father. You know, and I,
yeah, exactly.
I was living in this, you know, this default Keynesian world where we are this consumerist culture that is, you know, a product of that. This debt-based society, where we're all just kind of, you know, trying to keep up with the Joneses. And, you know, it's made me respect myself more and my time more. And that just changes you fundamentally.
Yeah, it does. And I think, you know, there are two approaches of talking about that. I think Bitcoiners use both. On the one hand, you can just create a funny meme and talk about it in a joking way and just say that Bitcoin fixes this, like every problem in the world, and just reply to it with Bitcoin fixes this. And it's basically saying the same thing, because if you had to explain it to people that lowering your time preference is just the way to fix most of the world's ills and just fixing the broken monetary system and the economic incentives we have in the world and getting rid of fiat money and fixing the easy money and stopping the printing presses is the way to fix a lot of shit in the world, then, I mean, it takes, I don't know how long, but it takes probably at least 10 or 20 concerted hours to convince somebody that this is not a crazy idea, you know? And the genius of Bitstein is that, and people like him, is that some of the Bitcoiners are able to condense it in a meme in three words, and it's orange coin good, number go up, Bitcoin fixes this. And that's the essence of what is like multiple months or years of intense study of Bitcoin. I mean, Michael Goldstein and Pierre Auchard, they come from the Austrian school already. So they had a head start of 10 years and then they discovered Bitcoin. And they are able to condense this deep knowledge about the world and how the economy works into three words. And it's, you know, number go up, orange coin good, and Bitcoin fixes this. And it's profoundly true. Like once you realize all those memes, they are not jokes. It's profoundly true. Then it really, it hits you hard, you know, like all of this, it kind of smacks you in the face. And I think this is also what will continue to happen in the next couple of cycles, that more and more people will realize that all the memes are true.
Exactly. Yeah. Each one of them is just a little, like a little white rabbit that you could sort of chase and follow right down the rabbit hole. You know, you could just, all you have to do is be exposed to one and be like, what does this mean? You know, you can follow it and it will teach you. I'll link a thread in the show notes, because I did a thread, this was September 18th. I just listed off a bunch of these memes, the 3 to 5 or 6 word memes. Yeah. And I was like, what else? And there's this whole thread of, like at least 100 different memes that the community's come up with over the years. Some of them are old and sort of like, not used so much anymore, but were really fun to go through and see sort of the history and the evolution of these Bitcoin memes. So yeah, it's just all this wisdom that's distilled down and condensed into just a few words. And that's, you know, Twitter is a great tool for that. And it's really honed our messaging. And when the next wave comes, there's just so much more, every cycle, so much more infrastructure built. And this cycle around, a ton of education infrastructure was built. And there's so much material out there now, and it's still building. There's, you know, just smart people coming in and year after year and building upon, you know, the shoulders, or standing on the shoulders of all the giants that came before them. And
yeah, exactly.
Like I was talking to Francis Puglio, at Bitcoin 2019.
Yeah.
And I saw in one of your notes that Francis said, you know, if you're in Bitcoin, you're in Bitcoin for 7 years, you need to take a year off, you know? And he kind of expressed the same thing to me. Yeah. He was like, you know, yeah, I feel like I can sort of step back now and kind of like focus on my business. And I spent so much time, you know, fighting the FUD and shitposting on Twitter and trying to educate people with the Bitcoin embassy and fighting against the Canadian government, trying to, you know, get them to understand what's going on here and not to ruin things by overregulating it and stuff like that. And now he's like, there, you know, there's so many people out that have sort of taken up that mantle that he can step back and kind of focus on other things and maybe like rest for a little bit.
I think it's really easy to destroy yourself in a way, because once you realize that this is a very important idea, you give it everything you have. And I think it's really easy to burn out and, you know, almost kill yourself in the space. Like, you know, people are starting companies and risking their livelihood and risking everything they have and just working, you know, like 14 hours a day. And that's not healthy. And I can just echo, it's something that Francis told me personally, and he just gave me like this tip in a way, like just take care of yourself, don't burn out, and after a couple of years, you need a year of break. That's the little secret that he knows. Yeah. it seems. And yeah, I intend to do that as well. Like I will, I will pull my foot from the gas pedal, and I'll have a baby soon, and I'll just take care of the baby. And I think I won't have time to shitpost on Twitter 24/7 anyway when the baby's here. So I'll just lean back and maybe read a bit of the Austrian economic books and read a bit of the great minds of Mises and Rothbard and so on, and just enjoy life. And you know, it's in my opinion, I found Bitcoin Zen almost in the last couple of weeks, and I'm really at a point where I just can lean back and watch the show and just see what happens. I still intend to work in the space full time. There's no going back for me. I just found what I really love to do, and I will work in the Bitcoin space no matter what, but it probably won't be 60 hours a week when I have the baby. So I see what I can do, and I'll collaborate with some people, and I intend to keep writing because I really like it. But I'm actually a software engineer by training, so I actually I could be useful as well. I could do more than just shitpost. Currently shitposting is the most fun, and so yeah, I'll see what happens. I might be able to release a book soon, and maybe a second one after that. So that's you heard it here first again.
That's exciting news, man. It's very exciting news. Yeah, you know, having a baby is just a really special time, and you do have to make sure that you you know, work really hard to force yourself to be present and really soak all that in. And it's just a really special, magical time. But there's also a lot of time to quiet time, to just kind of read and listen.
Because the babies are sleepy.
Yeah. Oh, man, they sleep 14, 15 hours a day usually.
That's awesome.
If you're lucky. But yeah, it was a kind of a magical time in our house. And I was lucky enough to have some paternity leave. So it was, you know, both of our kids, you know, we had 3 months at home together.
Nice.
You know, it was just, which doesn't happen in the United States very often. I know that it's more common in Europe, but that was just, those were really lovely times. And
I think I'll be able to do that as well, because I think I'll be able to do home office and just, take care of the kid as well. Yeah, exciting times.
Very exciting times, man. I'm happy for you. And the book too is really exciting.
Don't expect too much. Don't expect too much. Again, I'm a shit poster first, and stay humble also with your expectations. Like I'm just a shit poster, and again, like if the shit posts, they get really long, I just rename them and call them an article. And if I have a bunch of articles, I might turn something into a book or something. But you know, I have big plans, but also, you know, there are just so many blocks in a day. So there's limited time, and I see what I can do.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, anything last thoughts or words to kind of tie this thing up?
Not really. If you don't already, just if you want to see what my mind is up to, just follow me on Twitter. That's the best place. And if you haven't seen that already, I wrote 21 lessons. So that's a very good place to tumble down the rabbit hole. And if you want to listen to the previous episode I did with Brady here, we talked about the 21 lessons a lot. And I also do the bitcoinresources.com. which is also another entry point for the rabbit hole journey.
Yeah, those are all great resources, and we'll be linked to. And in that episode that we did on the 21 lessons is a perennial favorite. It's the most downloaded by sort of people who are new to the podcast. So I think, yeah, it's so people will come into the podcast and then they start going through the archive, and it's a very high percentage of people who are going kind of new to the podcast and go back through the archive that pick that are drawn to that particular episode. And it's, I actually re-listened to it this weekend. I put it on like 1.8x and blew through it pretty quickly, but it was a really, really good episode, man. Like it was, nice. It's really good.
I'll have to re-listen to it as well. Yeah. And sorry everyone for destroying all the high expectations with a lot of crazy talk.
Oh man, I think people will love this. I think this is, you know, I teased it at the end of last week's episode. And I was like, yeah, this is going to be a fun one. And you know,
we got cosmic really quickly. Like we were talking about, you know, citadels and stuff, and it was like 10 minutes in. So that was really good.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah. And I mean, this was a blast, man. Like most of the podcasts, like I told you before we started recording, I'll have a pretty clear outline and questions written out very, you know, specifically. And, you know, I just sat down on this with this one. I was like, I'm just going to chat with Gigi and see what's up, and we'll see where it goes. So this was a ton of fun, man.
Yeah, it was a ton of fun for me as well. Thanks for having me again, Brady.
All right. Thanks, Gigi.
Bye.
It is always great to chat with Gigi. He always pushes my understanding and appreciation for what's happening here to new levels, and I always come away more bullish than ever. Let us know what you thought about this one. Share a favorite quote or topic that we touched on in the episode, or just give Bitcoin Twitter a heads up that we're both crazy idiots. Gigi is at DerGigi, D-E-R-G-I-G-I, and I am at Citizen Bitcoin, of course. We definitely hope to hear from you. And again, you can support the BTC Pay Server project at btcpayserver.org/donate. Subscribe so you don't miss the Hasmacook episode next week. It should be another great one. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.